Hey everybody, Jonathan Dorr with you once again. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Catholic Teacher Podcast. Thanks so much for the privilege of your company. Man, time is the biggest commodity these days, isn't it? Time? We've been able to get people on the moon, we might get people to Mars, but we have not yet figured out a way to create more time. So I want to thank you for the privilege of you lavishing your time on this conversation, this podcast. I really do appreciate it. I hope and pray that you're going to get a lot of value out of this great discussion today. Look, before I introduce our guest, housekeeping as always, would you please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're hearing this, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Android, Spotify, or if you're listening here on the website, please subscribe. There'll be heaps of links. We do an awesome daily inspirational email. It's just a great quote every morning, 8 o'clock around the world. Thousands of Catholic teachers get this. So wherever you're hearing this, check out the show notes. There's going to be a link to the daily email. I want you to grab that. If you're on Facebook, would you please come and check out the Passionate Catholic Teachers Facebook group. We've got it's a private group. It's a closed group. So you just apply and we'll get you in there. But it's a great chance just to ask questions, to reach out and network with other Catholic teachers around the world. So come and join us there. Look, if you want to have me come and speak, I'm just about to do another two-week tour in the US. But if you want me to speak anywhere in the world, I've done keynotes now for over 400,000 people around the world. Awesome Catholic seminars for teachers, educators on a whole bunch of topics: Catholic identity, inspiration, well-being, burnout, resilience, pastoral issues for young people. If you're looking for a great seminar or keynote, please reach out to me. Just check out my staff page. I'd love to come and do that. Last thing, please check out the Going Deeper program. That is a weekly online formation inspiration program for Catholic teachers around the world. 400 schools on this planet already using that program every week. So we just felt that one of the key issues was that many Catholic teachers hadn't been given the type of formation they really needed. So this is a really awesome weekly online formation program. So when you're checking out the show notes here, just check out Going Deeper. Click through. There's a free trial. You're going to love that. Right, that's it. Let's begin. This is a good podcast today. I had an absolute blast. I got to interview somebody that I admire, that I respect, that I think is doing great work. How did this happen? Well, last year I was speaking in just outside New York in the Diocese of Rockville Center, and there was a break, and they'd invited a young priest to come in and just talk a little bit about the role of priests in schools and related topics, and it was very memorable. There was just something about Father Joe Fitzgerald. There was a humility and a compassion and a confidence that was really impressive, and you're going to hear that in this interview. He's currently the Director of Vocations for the Diocese of Rockville Center, but it's got a long, long background in youth ministry, in coming into schools. He studied teaching, went into the seminary at the age of 30. He's been a priest now for a long time and doing amazing work. In this conversation, we're going to talk about his journey. We're going to talk about the kinds of things that reach young people, that actually work and have an impact. He's going to share some advice with us about how we can all grow in our vocations as Catholic educators. So look, Father Joe Fitzgerald is an absolute gentleman. He's a dynamic, a passionate young Catholic priest who's going to share with us some great ideas. So I hope you get a lot of value out of this. Please, at the end, make sure you check out the links to go and see where you can follow up with Father Joe. But for now, wherever you are, kick back, grab yourself a coffee. Well, not if you're driving, but you get the point, and enjoy this great interview on the Catholic Teacher Podcast with Father Joe Fitzgerald from the Diocese of Rockville Center. Enjoy, people. Hey, everybody. Welcome back once again to the Catholic Teacher Podcast. This time, we have another fantastic guest. We have a guest joining us all the way from the United States. A gifted, a passionate young Catholic priest doing great work in a dynamic ministry. We're going to talk about a lot of great things. Father Joe Fitzgerald, welcome to the Catholic Teacher Podcast.
Thanks, Jonathan. Great to connect again with you. I hope things are well down under.
We were talking off air, and you're enjoying a bit of a nice summer. We've had an absolute our winters here are brutal. So believe it or not, everybody thinks Australia is all about, you know, riding kangaroos down the main street and sitting on beaches, but it's really cold here in the capital here at the moment. So you had a good 4th of July?
We did. A great time of family and celebration of the birthday of America.
And you guys, what's the 5th of July like for a lot of Americans? Is it do people take it pretty slow?
Yeah, so usually people really appreciate it when the 4th of July is like on a Thursday or a Friday or a Monday or Tuesday because you get an extended weekend.
Yeah.
But when it's in the middle of the week, people are a little disappointed because you have to go to work, as I did today. It's whoever didn't blow off the fireworks, they get to do that. The sanitation department comes around and picks up a lot of the blown up fireworks. That's the big July 5th celebration.
Good stuff. Well, listen, we're going to talk about a lot of great stuff. We first met last year when I spoke just outside New York in the Diocese of Rockville Center, and I hadn't met you before, but I felt that for those listening, Father Joe got up in front of a group of principals and Catholic education leaders just to talk about the role of priests and religious in Catholic schools. And I just felt that what you said that day was delivered with a great deal of passion, humility, empathy. And it really stays with me. I remember you sharing with us on that day, and I want to get to that. But just for our listeners first, take us a little bit through your backstory. Let's talk family. Let's talk how your vocation as a priest came about. You know, there are many options you could have taken in life. So take us to the background of your own Catholic journey.
Yeah, so I would be considered a cradle Catholic. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and mom and dad came from pretty big families. My dad was one of 8. My mom was one of 6. In their life, the church was a very important part of the journey and encouraged vocation, whether it be priesthood or religious life or strong marriage. That was really instilled in us as a family in the next generation. And still to this day, we're still pretty, most of my cousins and aunts and uncles all are pretty solid practicing Catholics because of what was instilled in us by our grandparents. And then we, as a family, we moved out a little bit further away from Manhattan and Brooklyn to Long Island. I was fortunate to go to Catholic elementary school and really have that foundation. What was being taught at home was continued in the school. Plus, the teachers and some of the religious that were there were really just on fire with the faith.
Take us back. You mentioned a really important word, instilled. We had a podcast a week ago with Lucy Robinson, who's just started a new Catholic school, and she talked about how that kind of basic formation, that basic Catholic worldview has gone missing for a lot of young people. But coming back to your early experiences, you use that word instilled. You talk about your grandparents. What are some of your earliest key memories of encountering the Catholic faith?
You know, I think back, probably the first thing I remember, like, as a memory was being, like, standing on the pew with my back against my dad's chest. I probably was about four or five years old and just kind of looking up at the mystery of what was happening at the Mass. And then I attended Catholic school in Brooklyn, and I remember my grandfather would walk me to school every day. And so there was just this whole sense of, like, that was the center of who we were, that the church, our faith was integral to what it meant to be a Fitzgerald, or on my mom's family name was Hearn. That was like primo. That was the most important part of who we are.
Wow. It's so cool to hear that. I said to Karen this week, my wife, I was at World Youth Day in 2008, which is a little while ago now, but I remember going up to communion there, and just before I walked up, I said to Karen, I had this really strong sense that the fundamental aspect of my identity, my sort of deep self of self-understanding, was my Catholic identity. I sort of felt you could take my career, you could take, you know, my businesses and all the stuff away from us, but the core thing was this sense of belonging to the Catholic Church. What do you remember your grandfather? It's interesting. He walked you to school every day. What do you remember of him?
I think that's a great example of like belonging. Certainly I remember seeing my teachers both when I was in Catholic school and also in public school later on, that they would come together at the Mass. And there was really that sense of almost kind of like that wink, wink, head nod that we were part of something that was special. So whether it be, you know, we were at Mass or we would go, what was a tradition was we would sometimes a treat would be going out to the diner after Mass and just kind of all going in together, that we were part of something different. Maybe some of the families that were there went to some other churches or they just came and rolled out of bed. But I really like that expression that you used, like a sense of belonging. We were part of something that not everybody either knew about or really understood, but that we were a community. That was really powerful.
So much of what you've said, you know, you talk about leaning back on your father's, with your back against your father's chest, like We made a decision as parents a little while ago. We went back to the cathedral for Mass, which is kind of how I grew up as a kid in a way. And the change in our kids, like my kids are still under 10 years of age, so we've got all our kids are under 10, but my son, you know, we are always front row every Sunday. We get there early. And it's funny what you said, how you looked up at the Mass. Like my son, he's a typical boy, right? Like he's a full 100% boy, but what's going on, the beauty of that building, like he's really captivated by it. And I think we'll get to this in our discussion, but you know, in the rush to be always appealing and entertaining, I think it's, for young people, I think it's always worth realizing that there are deep things worth holding on to. So tell us, you go through Catholic elementary school, you experience this witness in the home, you experience it in the family, you experience it in schooling. Your journey towards priesthood itself, when did that first begin for you, that first sense that there may be a call towards that vocation?
Yeah, I think, and I'm not sure if the same experience that you all have, or every parish or every diocese is a little bit different. Our diocese instituted what's called a pastoral year, and it usually occurred between the second theology and third theology. There was a seminarian who came to our parish, and he was very connected to the middle school. I think I was in seventh or eighth grade. And he would just come to stuff. And Jonathan, I got to be honest with you. Like my background would be like, I'd be like a sporty guy.
Yeah.
And this guy was not, he was not at all. And he's a priest today. He's now in South Carolina. He moved from New York to South Carolina, smart guy going down where it was a little warmer,
yeah.
But he just like showed up and he was so like available just to answer questions. And I remember going on a retreat with him. We went to the seminary at the seventh and eighth grade and just blown away with that experience again of that awe and wonder. And I think that that's where that became a little bit more of a reality. Not that I was ready to jump in. I certainly, you know, I was 13 or 14 years old and had a long way. I was 30 when I entered the seminary. But I remember that like those seeds were planted because I looked at this young man who, like, we shared a common love for the Lord. He would teach us in the class. So he was, you know, he wasn't a priest. He wasn't a teacher. He was the seminarian in between. And there was a little awe and wonder of that. It just like his just authentic love for Christ. Like I said, he was nothing like me, but except the fact that we share the faith and this passion and love for the Lord. Those are my first inklings.
It's interesting. In the staff seminars I do, I share a famous quote from Paul VI, who had that, you probably know it well, where he said that, you know, that the modern human person, you know, listens to witnesses more than they do to teachers. And said, if they do listen to teachers, it's because they're witnesses. So you're touching on something really important, both for religious but also for Catholic teachers, is it's that witness element that we can deliver the greatest theology lessons in the world, and we should, but it's something else, isn't it? It's when you see somebody in front of you who genuinely is carrying that conviction in themselves. Is that what happened for you when you saw the seminarian?
It did. I mean, I think that that's exactly it. I think it was somebody that was outside of my family and that immediate connection, but had those same values, the same, again, love for the Lord. And it was attractive. I think I've heard you speak about this often too, when you speak about different teachers, that how important it is for us as Catholic school teachers to be living the faith, because it becomes attractive that way. And it's okay. We don't have to have all the answers. And he didn't, you know, he certainly didn't have all the answers and was humble enough to realize that. And I think I've carried on that I pray I have that humility when people present me with some of the challenging subjects of theology or just the faith in general. But to see him again outside of my family as that witness of someone who, hey, I want to lay down my life for the Lord and the church, that was just really attractive and authentic.
Gosh, when you say that, you talk about laying down your life. I mean, the theology of, I guess, a priesthood and the theology, the arc of the Christian life is this, I guess, this mirroring in our own frailty and brokenness of the action of Christ in laying down his life. That, yeah, I think the essence of great vocation and great priesthood and great being a great Catholic teacher is this ability to love and to serve. But as you know, you said in the notes before we talked that we can't give what we don't possess. And we're going to get to that because I think that's the essence of how we can survive our vocations. Look, I want to jump into some of the heavy stuff. There's some obvious questions when people meet you, so we're going to put some photos up in the show notes, but if you haven't met Father Joe before, you know, he joked before about the seminarian that he saw wasn't the most sporty guy, you know, basically, I don't know how I say this. You're kind of you kind of look like the Catholic Tom Brady in a way. You're sort of, you know, you've kept yourself in really good shape. You obviously, you loved your sport. You've got to be one of those people. I mean, at times people have must have said to you, hey, you know, you could have done anything. You could have had amazing, you could have gone into business or done these things. How do you respond to that? Like, have you been asked that? People must say, hey, Father, you know, you're so young and dynamic and all this stuff. Where was the tension for you? I mean, how did you resolve that question as you went into your vocation? I mean, I guess what I'm asking you is, before I got married, I was in a Carmelite monastery and I was convinced that maybe God wanted me to be a Carmelite, but I also was, you know, I'd had a close relationship with Karen. And remember the head of the order saying to me, who's now a bishop, he said, look, the only thing that will drive out or replace a love is a greater love. So often people look at a vocation and go, look at everything you said no to. And I guess the answer is, well, it's not what I said no to, it's what I said yes to. And there was a greater love there. So just talk us through some of what I'm asking you, I guess. Take us through your journey around this decision to enter the priesthood.
As you were in the Carmelite monastery discerning, I was actually engaged. And there's a great story. My dearest and closest friend is he was a youth minister at my parish when I was living in Atlanta. And I just kept, like, I was hungering for more. And I remember at the time I was engaged and felt this call. And if you were to kind of put up, you know, just like the match card, the person I was engaged with, who's lovely and amazing and married with four children to this day, it kind of looked really good on paper. We would go to events. And like I tell you, it was great having her on my arm. She was wonderful and beautiful in all sense of the words. But there was something that was kind of like missing. And each time I would go and just get involved a little bit more with church and my faith and serving, I just remember having a conversation with this young man, Chris Benzinger, who's, you know, just a dear friend. And he asked me two questions, which I ask every couple when I prepare them for marriage. I said, in your walk and journey with life, who do you see honestly walking with you? Is it this person? And it was not. Like, I'm like, I don't see that. And then he asked me this question. He said, do you trust her with your soul to get you into heaven?
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't, you know, like I felt like I was at that time where we were in the relationship, I was carrying most of it, like that faith part. And I didn't see that she was my match. And so we broke off the relationship. And as I said, she's married and she's got four great kids and doing wonderful things. And I'm a miserable priest now. I'm just kidding. and I found my joy because as I discerned that, I realized, okay, this was where God was calling me, because I really started to listen to what he wanted from me and not what I wanted. Because as I said, you know, like there was something in the community that we lived in the sport community, you know, I had a little bit of a background in sports. So like there was this whole piece of like we had mutual friends and mutual things that we would go to. But then so it looked right, but it wasn't right at its depths. And so I often say that, like, in that time, I kind of felt like there was almost someone hitting me in the back of the head with, like, a 2x4 saying, like, hey, wake up, this is not where you're supposed to be. And what's awesome is I speak to people like you, Jonathan, who have had a similar experience where you've discerned into a religious order, into the priesthood, possibly seminarian, and there just was something missing. I'm like, I know what he's talking about. Like, yeah. I've had that feeling except in a different way. And both you and I, the key for us, I think, is the first love that we fell in love with is our love with Christ. And that only when you find the partner that's kind of help you get into heaven, you know, I think that that's where the two of you came together and said, this is our vocation. Well, my bride is the church. And I've really felt this incredible comfort. And we get caught up in so many things in this world about like the physical presence of people. And I experienced that from the standpoint of spousal love and companionship, as well as, you know, like children. I mean, like I did always, and this is a kind of interesting thought, I always felt called to be a father. And for whatever reason, like, I'm like, well, you got to be a father, you got to be like a husband then, you know, first. But I think like God had was preparing my heart to be just that, to be Father Joe, as a priest to serve his people, and not to be a father to a specific family. And it, you know, like you have the challenges sometimes, I'm sure you scratch your head and say like, oh my gosh, get me back in that monastery yeah. sometime. The quiet, you know? And so I know that we can kind of share that in some ways, because, you know, there's sometimes like, there's this awesome, beautiful story about you know, kind of going home on a Sunday night when families go home to dinner and prepare for Monday in school, there's sometimes a little bit of a melancholic ache that can be in your heart. But then I get back home and I put myself in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I'm like, Lord, this is where I desire to be. So it's that tension and that beauty and that joy that comes with, like, I'm going to really listen to you, not just what I want. And I think when we do that, we find that ultimate happiness, and that love is only replaced by a greater love, as you said.
There is so much in that. I was just listening to you. I remember in the monastery, the abbot there said that the success and the depth of your marriage will be in direct proportion to the quality of your individual relationships with Christ.
Amen.
And listening to you, it's like, you know, you talk about, is this the person, you know, that's going to get me into heaven? I look at Karen and I, and I think, you know, with all the many challenges of almost 20 years of marriage and the struggles and stuff, but it's interesting how we both really called each other forward in different ways. And listening to you, it's like my first thought listening to everything you just said was like, how good is God as a father that he actually eventually calls us into the vocation where he knows we're going to grow and we're going to serve and be most capable of love. So I think people they idealize vocations. I think people go, well, you know, if I became a priest, I'd be much happier and holier. Or if I got married, I'd be much happier and holier. It's like each of these vocations are different calls to holiness, yeah? And I think they crucially support each other. I mean, this was John Paul II was big on this, that, I mean, our marriage and our family life has been incredibly, incredibly enriched by great priests. It really has, you know, like I guess what we would call fecundity, right? The fruitfulness of your fatherhood has such an impact on couples and families. So, look, wow, that's gold. I wanted to ask you, your work with, I guess, with young people, you're still young-ish, you know, yourself, you're still a very young man. Tell us about this journey into working with young people. I want to ask you a simple question first. What do you most love about working with young people?
One of the things that I think is so important is that I don't think that in my experience of as a child or as a boy, and you spoke to this before a little bit about, you know, almost in some ways the simplicity and the wonder of the liturgy when you have your family in that front row looking up and your son is just kind of in awe. There wasn't like explosions like the 4th of July and the priest wasn't like rappelling into the sanctuary. There was just a real beauty to the way the liturgy was expressed and the message was clear, just like, hey, you know, God is love, but expanding beyond that, or God is merciful and expanding beyond that. And so what I love is really having the experience of being with the young church, particularly in the schools, whether it be the elementary or the high schools, and trying to communicate that without, again, some people are trying to make these explosions to make it more relevant or to make it more hip or whatever. I just like possibly taking the young people in a school out of their religion class. We're going to go down to the chapel. We're going to put the Blessed Sacrament out, and maybe we'll have some silence, maybe even do, not to sound crazy here, but maybe do like a little Latin chant of something, a song that even adds some of the wonder. Like, what is that? Like, he's talking some wacky language up there. Is he speaking to Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament in a different way? And like, it kind of piques their interest. And then like even something, I know, again, getting crazy here, but putting a little bit of incense in. And so there's the smells and the bells in just a subtle way, you know, like putting them in front of the Blessed Sacrament and seeing the kids come up in awe and wonder. The other great thing about, which I love about being in the school, is it's a teachable moment. So not that you would do this at every Mass and not that you would do it every Sunday, but to bring the students up and really just kind of unpack the liturgy and say, hey, this is why we put this little piece of bread in, or this is why I'm washing my hands. And to see like, hey, Father, you know, I've been a Catholic my whole life. And you're like, okay, you're 17 or you're 14. I get it, what you're saying. Like, I never knew that. And so I think there's, you can't overdo it. But I think when you have those teachable moments, like the subtle of being in front of the Blessed Sacrament with the young church, and then like saying, hey guys, wake up, this is what's happening, you know. And you can do that in the school experience, and that's why I really love being around young people.
So in terms of this work with young people in the school, the first thing that really struck me about what you said is there's been this drive for 20 years 30 years maybe to be as, you know, amusing and interesting as possible in youth ministry. I spoke in Minneapolis and I said, look, whatever you do, don't try and out-entertain the most entertained culture in history. So the minute we go, let's put on movies, let's just do pizza and that'll be enough. Now, interestingly, you look at, say, Bishop Robert Barron, who does take things like movies but really opens them up in an intelligent way and uses them as a teachable moment. But what you're talking about is this idea of giving them things that they can't get in their culture, which is like silence, stillness, contemplation, Eucharistic adoration. Oh, these things seem to be having a profound effect. But the question I want to ask you is, how do you balance the tension between what I'd probably call treasures new and old? Where's the balance between bringing out the riches of our tradition and using creative modern methods? I mean, I guess the last thing I'll say on that is the Easter Triduum this year, again, we took the kids to the cathedral. You got to get there like an hour early to get the front row at least. But, you know, there's my kids, and then the Archbishop comes in, you got all the incense. Oh, you know, on Good Friday, like he's lying prostrate before the altar. And that stuff, my kids are just like, why is the dude doing that? And I'm just like going, but it's like, you know, that beautiful, rich Catholic liturgical tradition captures their imagination. So my question again is, where's the balance between this? Because the critique is, oh, we're going back to pre-Vatican I, but we also don't want to become so hip and modern that we're no different to the surrounding culture. So how do you navigate that?
So I'm going to come around, I'm going to make a short story long, but again, I one of the things that I'm fortunate to have a background in athletics where I did pretty well and as a college athlete and then beyond that. And so this is a culture of worshiping at the altar of sport. And at the same time, it's a culture of worshiping at the altar of education and intelligence. And so we challenge our young people to be like all American or all county, or we want them to be the honor student. And so we challenge them to take the class that's harder, to try and be on the all-star team because it's harder. And we do the exact opposite with our faith. And I know a lot of other smarter and better theologians have said the same thing. Like, we dumb down our faith. And in dumbing down it, by in some cases, like you said, almost making it the MTV culture and like wacky graphics and trying to have a hipster up there to do things like the hipster priest. I think that, as you said before, we're trying to entertain the most entertained culture in the history of the world. But like, we need to call them up into greatness and challenge them into more. And we challenge them into more, I think, in the best way, by less. And so what does that mean? So not these explosions and all these graphics and all these outside things, but really bringing them into the silence of where God pierces through that they can hear. And I think that we need to walk them, not with, you know, maybe I love some of the contemporary Christian Catholic music that we have. There's some incredible musicians out there. And I think that that can be a tool that we can use. I don't think that we need to be going back to Lynyrd Skynyrd and Led Zeppelin and like, hey, there's that song that we can kind of, it kind of sounds churchy or gaudy, like, No. Keep it simple. Keep it real. And I think that's really attractive to our young people. And so back to looking at, as you said, like, we're not necessarily going back to Vatican I, but Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so if we look at the history and the beauty of the tools that the church has used from the beginning of time, recognizing that sometimes this word makes me want to vomit, but that we have evolved from what the Last Supper looks like and the liturgy that we have, but to say, like, there's beauty there, and to bring these young people to that and challenge them and to educate them more so through the experience of the witness and the encounter, and not get caught up in, we don't want to make Mass a course. Like, so there's times that we kind of put those teaching things into it, but you also don't do it with, hey, let's bring in the screens, you know, let's bring in the 72-inch screen that we watch the Super Bowl on and do some wacky things on there. Let's look at the tools that are appropriate to incorporate into the liturgy, which I think is music, which I think is a little bit more silence during the Mass, almost to the point that people might feel uncomfortable. Like, did Father fall asleep up there? Or like, no. Do you realize what you've just received? Now take some time to really contemplate how Christ is, like, you're becoming literally what you have just received. So, but I think that we live in a culture that says, rush, rush, rush. Let's do it in a Vine. Let's do it in a quick tweet. And I think, I'm not saying that we do a homily that's as long as War and Peace, but make it relevant and make it in such a way that is not overly wacky, you know, and when I keep using that term wacky, like, you know, I've just seen some priests who in their heart are trying to do the right thing, but they're trying to kind of, as you said, trying to entertain the most entertained culture in the history of the world. And with all due respect, outside of maybe a Bishop Barron who has the resources in Los Angeles, most of them are going to be stinky. They're not going to be as good as competing with the actual real Hollywood that's trying to bring them, these kids into like a relationship with hell, you know, ultimately.
There is so much in what you're saying. I hadn't really thought about it the way you expressed at the start there about how we have these expectations that students will have excellence in all these other areas. It's really interesting in Australia because in Australia we probably have a less of a focus on the – we're very much a sporting nation, but we have less of a focus probably in school. It's a big part of school life, but it's not probably as big as it is in the States. But there's a big pressure, especially here in the capital, to, you know, for academic excellence and you know, to have underwater cello playing as an option. And, you know, but you make such a good point that there's very few schools, very few Catholic schools even in this country that would go, you know what, we're going to be as serious about our faith formation, our catechetics, as we are about these other things. And look, the other thing I think you mentioned is, I can't remember who it was, the theologian that made the point that when the church abandons crucial aspects of its self-identity, these things don't disappear, they just get appropriated in other ways in the culture. And by that they meant, you know, when we lost the focus upon sacramental confession, he said that the human need for forgiveness and repentance and absolution didn't disappear. He said that basically what we got was Oprah and Ellen.
Right.
We get these culturally sanctioned places where celebrities can go to the cultural high priest and, you know, expose their inner workings and receive validation. The reason I'm saying this is that when we as a culture have lost silence, stillness, and contemplation, we get a mindfulness movement. We get, you know, all these other things. And I, listening to you, I think it's great to remind ourselves as Catholic educators that we have this tradition of being silent before the Lord, of being in His presence, of slowing ourselves down. But we seem to be losing it, which I think makes both the priesthood and Catholic education missionary work, because we're trying to bring that back. One last thing, I'll probably lose a few listeners saying this, but, you know, something you when you talk about that stillness and that silence and that beauty, you know, where we live here, most Saturday mornings I take the kids to Mass. It's a bit of a routine. We go to the 8 o'clock Mass. We go and have breakfast at a restaurant afterwards. We've done that for ages at our local parish. And a few weeks ago, we couldn't make it on time, so I hadn't been before, but there was an extraordinary form Mass on, where people would understand as a Latin Mass, and my 9-year-old son came. Now, this is my 9-year-old son that likes tackling me, you know, with no warning, playing Minecraft, you know, catching lizards, got the attention span of one of the characters from Finding Nemo. And we go to this Latin Mass, and I'd been a couple of times before in when I was in London, but we sit there and he's just dead quiet, just watching. And of course, it's super quiet. And then he really liked it. And we left. And then 2 weeks later, I said, mate, we're going to Mass Saturday morning. And he goes, Dad, which one are we going to? Are we going to the normal one or the quiet one? And I said to him, well, which one do you want to go to? And he goes, can we go to the quiet one? And you couldn't knock me over. I was like, dude, you serious? Like, and he was like, yeah. So, and I'm not making a great point for the listeners. My point is, you know, nobody has to go to the extraordinary form. I'm just saying that don't for a second believe that our young people don't have a great openness to and a responsiveness to the great beauty and richness of the tradition. So here endeth my sermon. Now, I wanted to touch on something beautiful that you said when I heard you speak in Rockville. You were very poignant and open about the abuse scandals and what it's like to be a priest coming into the school setting. And I really stayed with me. Can you talk to us a bit about we urgently need priests and religious back in our schools as a presence, as a witness, as companions for all of us? Tell us about that experience. Share a bit of your heart with us about what that's like as a priest these days, to be in that educational context. How can you help Catholic educators understand the need for that? Just riff on that for us for a little bit.
Yeah, so, I mean, my first experience really with working with young people. I was studying to be a teacher. I started with phys ed and then I went to history. And so we went over some basic things that were really instilled with me on how to act with young people that were not done in the seminary. And so just basic things about never being alone with students and 3D, you know, leadership and so, you know, those kind of things. And so it was just a basic normality for me being around young people that was not instilled in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s when, you know, some of these horrific things were happening. And so for me to come in, like, I had this like, hey, I'm all fired up and this is what you do, how you act around young people, and trying to encourage some of my brothers who were in the seminary and even some of the priests that I interacted with. And there was such a hesitation and fear to be around young people because of what happened in the scandal. And there's absolutely no excuse. Like, you can't say compare this to that, to this group or that family member and all this kind of stuff. You know, so much was entrusted into Catholic priests, and in our humanity, we failed. And then we failed as a church in kind of protecting young people. And I think that we're in a place that is so much better now. And so the way teachers are prepared, and even more so, there's a higher expectation for seminarians and priests, anybody that work in the church. And so I think that one of the things that has to happen, I mean, Jonathan, I don't think there's anything more intimidating than walking into a cafeteria, whether it be elementary school, middle school, or high school, whether you are a child or an adult, and looking for that affirmation of what some kid to look you in the eye and say, you're welcome. Come here. Come to our table. Sit here. And I remember as a chaplain and being in the high school, walking in there and like just yearning for someone to give me a little bit of an acknowledgement. As soon as that happened, boom, I could get over there and I felt welcome. And I think what I shared, you know, when we were together over here in New York was that, like, to encourage teachers to, if you have, this is just a terminology I use, but if you have Father Awkward, okay, who's maybe a little bit older and maybe not as comfortable, like throwing a ball or something, that you go grab him and say, hey, Father Awkward, come on over here. Here's a bunch of kids playing kickball or shooting a basketball or just having a conversation. That it, like, to begin with the adults, you know, like begin with the teachers and the administrators to say, you know, like Father desires to be that young priest that feels really comfortable in front of young people, but kids are intimidating, you know, and they're almost afraid to go do it. And so to ask the, you know, like some of the Catholic educators, administrators, and teachers to be the one to say, come on over here. We want to introduce you to the kid who's most extroverted, who will make you feel comfortable. And, you know, and the more that happens, the less of that fear and awkwardness comes, and they just come in and they're just regular Father, and the kids feel welcomed and loved and want to have a conversation and interact with them. And I think that there's such a wake from the scandal that many priests are really still afraid to do that. In some cases, will refuse to do it if they're welcomed or invited. That's where we can do this together, because there are certain things that, you know, our amazing Catholic school teachers out there that nobody can do except them. They're so gifted and talented, and like nobody could substitute for that. And in the same way, there are certain aspects of the priesthood that, hey, you know, hey, Father, I'm really uncomfortable talking about, you know, like confession. Can you come in and speak to the kids? Or I'm not really quite sure I understand celibacy. Can you come and speak to the kids? And that kind of invitation will help remove, I think, some of that uncomfortableness, maybe awkwardness or lack of or fear that some of the priests have because of what happened. Like, does every kid look at me and say, hey, that guy with the collar might want to abuse a kid or my kid or students? Like, as soon as we kind of iron that out or calm that down a little bit and make it a welcoming place, then I do believe that you'll see some of these priests a little bit who might feel a little uncomfortable to come there. Because as I said to you before, there is nothing more intimidating than walking in to a high school, middle school, or elementary school cafeteria. Because all a kid has to do is look away and you're cut out.
Wow.
But once there's that connection, once there's that connection, and to be that teacher or the administrator who creates that bridge, I really believe that it's going to strengthen Catholic schools, but it's going to open up questions about vocations. It's going to open up strengthening the, hey, I think I want to go to that priest because I was eating my peanut butter and jelly sandwich and it was just fun. I felt like I could speak to him about anything. Right. I'm just going to share one other thing that, you know, kind of what you said before. You talked about the Oprah and the Ellen generation. You know, I speak to people. I have some good friends who go into Manhattan and they go to these life coaches and they go to these counselors. They pay $1.75 an hour to sit there, $175 an hour to sit there and talk to these guys about their problems. And I'm like, on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock,
you can achieve a lot more in 10 minutes listen, going to Father. And then the best part at the end, your sins are forgiven.
Amen.
And I think when we create these relationships again, where there's not fear-based, but love-based between the clergy and the people of God, especially with our young people, you know, Jonathan, you talk about this all the time about transforming our culture, transforming our world with education, with like encouraging, empowering, strengthening our teachers. If we can make this team effort again with the clergy and the incredible teachers that are out there, like Jesus won. It's all over. We just have to put the team together and give them the tools and the strength and the encouragement, and the sky's the limit. I mean,
so good.
It is going to be an effort to kind of really encourage people out there to help.
So good. I want to ask you on what you're saying, the presence of priests and religious, like when I did the keynote for NCEA in St. Louis, you know, we had 10,000 teachers there. One of the strongest memories I have, we have a bit of a special relationship here in Australia with the Dominican sisters from Nashville. And I'm in the hotel lobby in St. Louis, and we were tired. We'd literally just come from Iceland. We'd flown from Iceland to Washington, then St. Louis. I got three kids in tow. We're all sort of tired. And I was thinking, man, I got 10,000 people in front of me in 48 hours, and all this is going through my head. And this bus pulls up, right? And off this bus just comes this great big tribe of Dominican sisters in their full habit. And I tell you, it was like the Marines at Normandy. It was like the spiritual atmosphere just lifted. Something was just like this. I got this sudden encouragement, and it was like, you know, not being flippant, but as if spiritual forces just fled, and there was just this beautiful presence there. Now, the reason I'm sharing that is the Dominican sisters here, we have them in some of our Australian schools, and their witness and the beauty of their vocation is so transformative. And my kids, my three children at home, have grown up with these sisters, like coming to our house and being around us. And so what I'm asking is, we've been blessed by it. What do you think are the key things that priests and religious can bring into the school environment? What are some of the key reasons? Because you've explained to us, okay, principals, you know, superintendents, here's why, here's how you can make this easier, but tell us why they should. What is it that priests and religious can bring? What's the essence of what they bring into a school?
So I guess my first response is, my identity is I'm a beloved son of the Father. And in that identity, I've been called to this incredible gift to serve as a priest and to serve the church as a priest. And one of the things that we have, and it varies depending on what part of the world you're in, but we do have part of our identity is a fireman has a uniform, you know, a physician has a uniform going in, police officer. And there's something powerful about, you use the term the habit for the Dominican sisters, or as you would say, the blacks for us, you know, wearing the blacks. That's not our identity. Our identity is beloved daughters and sons of God. However, when we come into an experience, even sometimes people are like, what are you wearing that for? You know, like a sister will walk up and they're like, you know, priest is wearing a cassock, which I'm not a big cassock guy, but like, are you from the Matrix? Are you like some special lady with this habit, all that kind of stuff? So what it does is it causes, and especially our bold youth, to ask questions. What does that mean? Why do you have the rosary? Why do you have that white collar? Why do you have the veil? Like, and then when a sister says like, this is my wedding dress, and the veil that I'm wearing is like the veil that you would wear when you walk down your aisle to your beloved. And the beloved at the end of the aisle is Jesus waiting for me. And the beauty in telling that, or to say again, like, I wear this because it's a sign so people can say, I'm struggling with this. But that guy over there who's got that black suit on or the black shirt and the collar, I know I can go to him and I'll receive mercy. And so when you have the presence of the religious sisters and brothers and priests into the community, invited into the classroom, walking through the schools, the children begin to understand who they are and what their presence is. Not that are, again, the incredible dedicated Catholic educators are lay women and men who do an incredible job and amazing, in some cases, way holier than me. But having the presence of the priests and the religious really just kind of like enhances and strengthens that identity. And as you said before, it's almost like, hey, the Navy SEALs are here. You know, there's the reinforcements are here, and there's a boldness that comes out that people can come and say, I need to go speak to them. Like, there's something beautifully attractive about how this religious sister has said yes. In some cases, very, very young. In some cases, very mature, you know, a little bit older, and they've been teaching for a long time. And the same thing with the priesthood. that's what I think is the benefit of encouraging religious and the priest to be within the classrooms and within the school.
So true. And I think, you know, the theological dimension of this, and a few listeners would know about it, it's worth understanding, is it's what's called the eschatological dimension, like the Greek term eschaton, meaning, you know, the end times or the end of all things, that you as priests and other religious, you witness for us in your life, your vocation, and even in, you know, your dress at times, the reality that we all are going to embody, that ultimately that you guys have made a total gift of self to the pursuit of relationship with Christ. And having you in our schools, you know, is a reminder for all of us about that, that really the focus, the arc of all our lives is going to be about that ultimate relationship, that consummated relationship with Christ at the end of time. So that sounds kind of all a bit heavy, but it's that deep, rich symbolism that's just been missing, I think, for a generation, that we have to find a way back to because it's so rich. I want to ask you about how all these wonderful Catholic educators who are listening to us, superintendents, principals, my focus is on how they can take better care of themselves. My thesis for the last 5 or 10 years at least has been that you can't do a supernatural task with natural resources, that the cynicism, the exhaustion, the burnout, the fatigue comes from giving and giving and giving and working so hard but not being restored. Talk to us about, from your pastoral experience, what do Catholic teachers need to be doing to deepen their relationship with Christ, to let him carry them in their vocation? Give us the big picture things, but give us some concrete things you think teachers need to take away from this discussion and start doing or do more of so that they can really become the person that Christ's calling them to be.
You know, I think I love to use, again, sports analogies to help. If you decided to take up running tomorrow, if you decided to take up weightlifting tomorrow, it is unlikely that you would start with a marathon. It would be unlikely that you're starting with powerlifting. Like, you start with the basics and you run from the driveway to the top of the block and back, or even walk. And so I think that, like, there's not necessarily like this magic arrow, like that's going to do all of it like in a big way. But I think you begin small. And one of the great gifts about working in Catholic education with, again, these incredibly dedicated, as you said, the superintendents, the principals, the individual teachers in each of the classrooms. I remember there's this constant battle about making time for like a day of recollection. We had time for, you know, the Common Core. We had time to talk about this new grading system. You know, there's new technology going on. And it took, when I was in the schools, like, it took a while to finally get that day of recollection. There were like the skeptics who were like, come on, Father, we got to get through this. You know, like, let's get through. I don't want to be sitting here all day doing this Jesus stuff, you know, in the most, as you said, the most cynical way. Like, sometimes that hits us.
Yeah.
And then the end of the day comes, and the most, you know, cynical, this is not fair to all the PE coaches out there, but in this particular case, it was a PE coach who's like, hey, Father Joe, you know, that was pretty good today, you know, and a person who barely wants to even speak to you, you know, because you're taking time away from their basketball foul shots or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, we have to make time to build up the spirit beside. So I worked with this incredible woman who every morning she would go down, she would have her cup of coffee, and she would do about 45 minutes of reading the scriptures. She would light a candle, and then she had this little chair. I went to her house a bunch of times, her husband and family, they were like, oh, that's mom's chair over there. And that could be intimidating to hear that, like, oh, I have to have a space, I have to light a candle, I have to have the coffee, I got to be there for 45 minutes. But I would say the most practical way is, if you get up at 5:30 or some of you get up at 4:30, whatever it might be, wake up 5 minutes earlier and use that the first 5 minutes to just reset and say, I'm going to just do an intentional prayer and name all the people in my family, or I'm going to read the scriptures that are going to be read at Mass today. And start small. And what you'll see is, just like when you go to the weight room, when you start jogging, like, you can go a little bit more and a little bit more. But start in those most basic ways. Or so many schools are so blessed to have a chapel. Very often we'll have a planning time. Right now the teachers are laughing and saying, planning? Usually I'm covering a class. Maybe I'm going over here. You know, we understand you being pulled in a lot of different ways. But when you have that, maybe go into the chapel and begin with that 5 minutes of quiet, allowing the Lord to pierce your heart. And then build off of that. If we don't have that, if our hearts are not filled up with the mercy and love of God, then we can't give it to others. then my challenge is to the superintendents, my challenge is to the department chairs or the principals, and saying, like, you have to, if you're going to do that technology day, if you're going to do that grading day, I would say that at least once a year, if not once a semester. Again, I know I'm asking a lot, but there's got to be that day of recollection, or the morning part of that day of that staff training day is going to be geared towards some prayer time. And not the prayer time like, oh, take an hour and do your own thing. But maybe it is, like we spoke about before, maybe it's Mass or putting the teachers in front of the Blessed Sacrament and just having a little bit of quiet contemplation, or give them a couple of questions to reflect on. You know, I think that's where we can team up together, because the God guys or the God girls, the priests or the religious, you know, we spend a lot of time in that formation. We have a couple of, you know, tricks up our sleeve, and we can help create a day. So ask the pastor, ask the chaplain, ask some of the religious, some of those dedicated religious, to come up with some just simple things. Hey, at the beginning of Lent, we're going to pray the rosary every Monday morning, or we're going to have 5 minutes of quiet time during our lunch break before we go eat and get in that teacher workroom and start, you know, cutting up on the bishop or something else. Not that anybody does it out there, John. You know, that doesn't happen. Okay?
Never happens.
Not the principal, the superintendent. But just in case that might be out there, like, hey, maybe, again, put Christ at the front, at the center. Those are the practical ways. But to begin small, to not expect to be transformed, and it has to be consistency. We can run a mile. We can lift 200 pounds only when we do little by little by little and build up on that. So that would be my, like the most basic building blocks, is to challenge everybody to take a little bit of time.
I love that. It reminds me of, you know, John of the Cross used to give the image of prayer, like putting a big log on a fire that, you know, when you put that log on, sort of nothing happens for a while, and then the impurities slowly start to get, you know, transformed, and they change, and over a long period of time, that log actually becomes the fire. You know, yes. You can no longer tell. So I guess in our spiritual journey, it's that we begin small, and not a lot seems to happen, but there's this gradual transformation. Look, I wanted to ask you just a quick couple of final things. Really simple one. I want to ask you from your heart, what do you most enjoy or value about your priestly life? What's the one thing that you can look at in all your interactions and all your experiences of the vocation that God's called you to that is most precious to you?
I think it's just an incredible gift each day. It's one and two, is to be able to have the opportunity to pray over and reflect on the scriptures at Mass, and to be able to communicate that, like how the Lord speaks to me. So to be able to pray with his word and to communicate something. I mean, there could be nothing better than the opportunity to be able to bring forth the Eucharist. I mean, like, to be Christ, to say his words and to bring him into the world are just the most, like in that whole aspect of Mass, it's really the core of my identity. And like, I get emotional thinking about it, like, the incredible gift I have, as you said before, the busyness of all these Catholic school teachers. Hey, I don't even have 5 minutes. Like, there's no excuse, and the beauty of I have to mull over the Word of God to make it become who I am, and then to bring forth the Eucharist each day. It's just the most incredible gift that I have.
And it's so beautiful to hear. I might have shared this once before, but I was staying at St. Patrick's Church in London, Soho, with an amazing priest there called Father Alexander Sherbrooke, and he's in the middle of the most Soho district in London is just the most wild, crazy, kind of debaucherous, alternative lifestyle part of London, and there's a lot of pressures there. And he took me out for dinner, and we were chatting, and he's a really interesting man. He's an older priest now, and I sort of said to him, I said, look, in the midst of all the craziness around here, how did you kind of hold on to such a deeply Catholic evangelical faith? He's a really solid operator. And he said, oh, he goes, I'll tell you a story. He said, I was a bit wishy-washy. He said, I was kind of not really, you know, being the greatest priest I could be. And he said, I ended up on this trip to Calcutta in India. And some people took him to say, hey, we can get to see Mother Teresa. And he ended up on this bus. And they all have to line up, and she's going to come through and just say a quick hello to people. And he tells this story where she comes around the corner. There's about 50 people there, but he's the only priest that day. And she makes a beeline straight for him, and she grabs his hands and holds his hands and squeezes his hands and then kisses them. And she's whispering over and over again to him, the hands of a priest, the hands of a priest. And he said that moment, he said, just changed his vocation, his life. He just said he had a sudden realization of the incredible privilege and beauty of that sacramental gift. Look, I know as a layperson, I guess the critique is we don't want to create this, you know, idolize things in an inappropriate way, but I think what the gift that you bring us as priests in your pastoral service and care for us, but the sacramental aspect, I don't think as lay people we tell you enough just how precious it is. You know, it sustains our family life, it sustains our community life. So game on, I say. If you can imagine walking on stage, you've got 100 young teachers in front of you who are about to start their first week ever as Catholic teachers. And you can tell them three one-sentence or one-word things, three crucial pieces of advice that you'd give to a group of Catholic educators. What would they be?
I think the most important thing I would say is begin with Christ. Start with a prayer before and ask the Lord into the conversation, into the class, into the course, whatever it might be. So begin with a prayer and invoking Jesus. He's the great teacher. He's the first teacher. So bring Christ in first. The second thing I would say, be authentically you. There are a lot of books and methods on how to do things, but you've been called to duty to serve the church and these young people as you with your gifts and talents. So be authentically you. Last thing I would say, do not be afraid to transform or change into what's coming up. So don't be afraid of technology. Don't be afraid of possibly some newness that comes out, because we can get caught in a comfort and say, like, I've always done it this way. So you young folks, you inspire us, but don't be afraid to, that newness might be coming from one of the older the older generation teachers. So put Christ first, be authentically you, and don't be afraid to transform and change into some of the newness that's being presented to you as a Catholic educator. And thank you. I'd say thank you for saying yes to serve.
Amen. Father Joe Fitzgerald, I want to thank you on behalf of all our listeners for making time for us today. I've actually really enjoyed it. If you could see me here in the studio today, I've got a big smile on my face. It's a joy to listen to you. I want to thank you for your vocation and for all that you bring to so many people and that you're going to be bringing in the future. I'm going to point everybody in the direction of where they can follow you, social media, website, so people can reach out. But on behalf of all of us today, just thank you so much for who you are and for making time for us on the Catholic Teacher Podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan. Be assured of my prayers for you and Karen and the children. And thank you for your yes. You're an incredible inspiration. You are like the Navy SEALs coming and getting us all jacked up to go out there. So your vocation is an inspiration, brother. God bless you.
I love it. Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. Hey, everybody. Jonathan once again. How good was that? Wasn't that great? Doesn't he just strike you as somebody that would be a blessing to be in front of young people? So look, wherever you're hearing that, I hope you can reach out and follow up on his social media profiles, check out his website, get in touch, let him know what you thought, post some comments here wherever you're hearing it. But I just loved it. I just think it was great to hear his story and his compassion for young people and his genuine respect and appreciation for the great work that you're doing as Catholic educators. So that's it from me. Please make sure you've subscribed to the podcast. Do one thing for me. If you can, grab the link to this podcast. Grab it now, right now, and post it on your social media feeds. Tell people to have a listen. That would be a huge blessing for us. I've got a real heart just to see this grow. I want, you know, thousands and thousands of Catholic teachers around the world to hear these stories and to be encouraged. So I'd love your help in doing that. Please check out all the links in the show notes. If you want me to come and speak, or check out the Going Deeper program. But for me, last thing, thank you for what you do. I think Father Joe said that too. Be encouraged. I know it's hard, it's challenging at times, it can be exhausting, but what you're doing is making a difference in the world. So thank you so much. Stay close to Jesus. We're going to have another great podcast interview for you on the Catholic Teacher Podcast with me, your host, Jonathan Doyle, next week.